Good afternoon. It's wonderful to see so many familiar faces, but for those that I haven't met before, hi, I'm Sasha Smith, a GST partner at Deloitte and a member of the organising committee for the conference. We've marked the 25th year of the GST with cake and cookies. We're also marking it with a new filing obligation. So this session will unpack the annual supplementary GST return. We'll talk through the content, the purpose of the return across the top 100 and top 1000 markets, and then also share some insights and experiences from those that have been through preparation of the return. So I would like to introduce the panelists. So we have Michelle Sams joining us, Assistant Commissioner for the top 100 group as of today. As of Monday, Michelle will be Acting Deputy Commissioner for Public Groups as Rebecca Saint moves into her new role. We have David Wilson, Director at the Tax Office in the GST Risk Hub, Chris Plakius, Indirect Tax Leader at Westpac, and Jonathan Paul, GST Manager at Woolworths. So I'll hand over to David, who's going to do an initial presentation on the SAGA and its content and purpose.
Beautiful. Thanks, Sasha. G'day, everyone. Pleasure to be here this afternoon. As Sasha said, it's great to see so many familiar faces that I've dealt with over the years. Look forward to reconnecting with many of you over the course of the conference. But first, let's spend a little bit of time talking about the supplementary annual GST return. Okay, so last year we announced the introduction of the supplementary annual GST return, and it's for large businesses that have had a GST assurance review, with the first year being the 2024-25 year. The return allows us to better tailor our engagement with the taxpayers under our top 100 and top 1000 justified trust programs for GST. The idea is that once we have a baseline level of assurance over a taxpayer's GST reporting through the initial assurance review, that we use the information that we obtain annually through this return to really top up that understanding in relation to their GST governance and their reporting, so that we can really tailor our future engagement with them. We've designed the return to be pretty straightforward to complete, so hopefully on Jonathan Ackerman's scale we might get a smiley panda or a happy panda on that one, we'll see. But it focuses on understanding the key governance and GST system changes that might have happened throughout the year, understanding the work the taxpayer has done to address any ATO recommendations from the earlier reviews, and also whether they've completed the GATT or a similar reconciliation. The information provided will enable a more targeted justified trust review approach with a view to that requiring less resource investment from many, perhaps most, taxpayers. We expect that taxpayers who have achieved higher levels of assurance will get the most benefit, but even though it's early days, we're seeing that some of that reduction in intensity is flowing through to other taxpayers as well. We'll also use the information provided to identify and monitor GST risks, and we'll differentiate our approach where we identify specific issues that require further engagement with taxpayers, and that may well happen outside of the normal assurance context. Michelle will shortly give some insights into how we use the information that is provided in the top 100 and top 1000 justified trust programs, and also give some of the observations that we have received so far in relation to the first bunch of returns that were lodged just a couple of months ago in August, but also through the pilot program. Early indications are that from the returns that we've received so far is that many taxpayers are investing in their governance and making progress against the recommendations that have been made in the earlier reviews. We're also pretty encouraged that on the returns that have been lodged so far, somewhere in the order of about 75% of the taxpayers have completed the GAT and have provided the information, the results of their GAT analysis to us, which is good. Okay, so who's required to lodge? Public and multinational businesses that have received a GST assurance rating through top 100 or top 1000 assurance reviews are the entities that are required to lodge. The return was lodged, was introduced for the 24-25 financial year, and all taxpayers who received their assurance report on or before 30 June 24 will need to lodge for 25. Similarly, rolling forward, any taxpayers who receive a report on or before 30 June 25 will need to lodge in respect of the 25-26 year, and so on. Last year, in relation to the 25 year, we went out to all of the taxpayers that would need to lodge and we emailed them directly to inform them of that. In terms of the due dates for the lodgements, they are all linked to the individual taxpayers' financial years and are basically 7 months after the due date of the last BAS in their financial year. All of those dates are set out in a table on the website, but the key dates for the first lodgements are 21 August 25, just gone now, for the December balances, and 21 February 26, which was coming around pretty quick, for the June balances. The way we communicate currently, if taxpayers need to lodge for the 25 year, we're sending them a notice by both email and post, and that's done about 4 months in advance of when their lodgement is due, and given that that's the way we're communicating at the moment, we just encourage everyone to keep their contact details maintained with us on our systems. If anyone has questions in relation to whether they have to lodge, when they need to lodge, the scope of the coverage of the lodgement, anything like that, use the email address on the screen there. That's actively monitored by my team. Pleasingly, there's already a, let's say, healthy traffic through that email address, which is really good because it shows a bunch of people who are really actively sort of managing their obligations in this regard. So that's great. So I'd encourage anyone to reach out about your own affairs or your clients, as the case may be. It's also the address to use in the event that someone's looking for a deferral. We have had a small number of deferral requests. All I would say at this point about them is the supplementary return is a return. It's not like an RFI. And so we would need to take into account the relevant practice statements when considering any requests for deferral. All right, so I'll now briefly run through what each of the sections on the return cover and the questions themselves. There's a heap of information on the website. In fact, once we finished the pilot and the consultation, there was a suggestion that we add a significant amount more guidance, which we did. And in particular, I would like you to look at the example that we've included of how to complete a return. It's a lot like a sample completed return. I think there's a lot of guidance there that tells people what we're after in relation to the questions, but that one's important because it really gives an indication of the detail that we think is most useful when the return is completed. Okay, so just running through it briefly, starting with section A, the first three questions simply ask for the details of the entity that's lodging the return. Section B talks to how taxpayers have actioned recommendations, areas of low assurance or red flags. So question four simply asks whether there are any actions that remain outstanding at this point. Obviously, our expectation is that any recommendations that have been flagged are being actively addressed over time. Question five then asks for an explanation of how any ATO recommendations have been actioned and also how any areas of low assurance or red flags have been resolved. Question six asks for an explanation of any actions that remain outstanding. So useful responses that we've received in relation to question six demonstrate a good understanding of what's yet to be done and also gives us a bit of a sense of the timing that we might expect some of those things to be done, which will be, again, useful on an annual basis when subsequent supplementary returns are submitted. Section C is all about GST governance. Question seven asks whether a taxpayer has had any material business changes or any material system changes that might impact the entity's GST control framework. And if the answer is yes, we just want an explanation of what those, of the nature of those changes. Question eight is from a taxpayer's perspective, whether they consider that they meet the criteria to either maintain or increase the GST governance stage rating that was given in the most recent GST assurance review. And question nine, they're asked to provide some reasoning for that answer. So now we move on to section D, which is about the reconciliation between the audited financial statements and the business activity statements, so the GAT or some form of similar reconciliation. Question 10 simply asks whether taxpayers have completed the GAT or similar. If yes, question 11 asks for the results of that analysis, so the effective GST rate on sales, the effective GST rate on expenses, and the net effective GST rate. And question 12 asks for comments on any remaining variance thereafter. And if no, question 13 asks for an explanation of the reasons for that. And again, some explanations that we've received that are useful include, for example, that an organisation might be predominantly input taxed. In some cases, the GAD is underway but is not yet complete and it'll be provided at a certain date, or it's, scheduled as part of a forward work program, or is being reviewed externally by an advisor or whatever as the case may be. Just important that we can get a sense through these responses of what the GAT journey is for the taxpayer. Section E is about material uncertain GST positions. Question 14 asks whether taxpayers have taken any material uncertain GST positions in the period, and if yes, we want a description of each of those positions. There's a lot of examples, I think, and example scenarios that we've provided on the website in this context that I'd encourage people to have a bit of a look at. For this purpose, uncertain positions are positions which are about as likely to be correct as incorrect, even if they're reasonably arguable. Positions contrary to ATO public rulings or other ATO public advice and guidance. Positions contrary to a private ruling or to which an ATO taxpayer alert applies, or where there's a moderate or high risk rating under a PCG. And for this question, materiality is set as $500,000 for a top 100 taxpayer and $250,000 for a top 1,000 taxpayer. And then finally, we move on to section F, which is about material GST reporting errors or credits that have been claimed in a later BAS. Question 15 asks about whether taxpayers have identified any material GST errors and how they've been rectified, and also whether they've claimed any material amounts of credits in the period of the return that were referable to an earlier period. So in terms of errors, we'd want to see the total extent of errors, the gross amounts of the errors, not the netted off amount of the errors, a description of the errors, and we'd also want to get a sense that the cause of the error has been sort of identified and is being being addressed. And the materiality level for this question is the same as the last one, 500,000 for top 100 taxpayers and 250,000 for top 1,000 taxpayers. So that's just a bit of background and a bit of an overview in terms of what the supplementary annual GST return is and the information that we're seeking in it. I'll hand over now to Michelle. And she's going to talk to how that information is used in the programs and in particular some of the nuances that exist between the top 100 and the top 1,000 populations. Michelle.
I think, as you foreshadowed, we're really using the supplementary annual GST return in our top 100 and our top 1,000 programs to, I suppose, better tailor our engagement and where we can take a lighter touch where we've already got high assurance. So we think at the moment, based on what we've seen, that it will be the high assurance taxpayers who stand to benefit the most because, like, and I'll talk to these changes, some of the changes we're thinking about implementing or we are implementing is how we really reduce the level of intensity of our reviews in relation to these taxpayers. So where we have information through the supplementary annual GST return that gives us confidence that the high levels of assurance that we've seen and built up through our assurance reviews is being maintained and there's continued investment in things like governance and correct reporting, we have confidence to have a lighter touch with those taxpayers, but still maintain our level of confidence, right? Top 100 and top 1,000 taxpayers contribute a significant amount of the GST collected, and it's really important that we have some visibility and that we're able to say with some confidence that we continue to have assurance. The way the return is being used in the program is very similar, but just with the different, the way the programs are run a little bit differently in practice, it's being applied a little bit differently. So we've recently finished some public consultation on the changes we've proposed in the Top 100 program. So if you're not aware, with Top 100 taxpayers, we have that continual engagement, a dedicated team who's engaging on a regular basis. So for high assurance or taxpayers that have high assurance for GST, we have committed in eligible circumstances, and I'll talk a bit more about those in a minute, to really limit the scope of our future engagement. So rather than do a refresh review every 4 years where we do more of a detailed review to understand if we can rely on our previous assurances and carry it forward into the future, to really limit our engagement to what we're calling an assurance check-in. And really, that's premised on the fact that to be a high assurance taxpayer, we've got confidence that you've got effectively designed controls, and in due course, you'll be having those independently tested, because that was a requirement for stage two, that we've got high assurance over your correct reporting and that you've completed the BAS. So we've got that kind of top-down reconciliation of what's being reported in your financial statements versus what's in the BAS. So going forward, we'll be predominantly looking at the results of independent controls testing and then your GAT. So if we identified something through the GAT that looked different, you know, or through our continual monitoring of, you know, things that are lodged, if we identified something that looked different or presented a new risk or something we didn't understand before that undermined our assurance, of course we'd ask you further questions about it, but really the intention is that we'll be very streamlined in our engagement, and absent anything that causes us concerns, we'll limit our engagement. The consultation for that has now finished. We did get some feedback. It was all very like encouraging, constructive. Taxpayers and, you know, associations that engaged on it are in favour of a reduced intensity of our engagement in appropriate circumstances, which is, you know, what we were expecting. And we are moving to roll out next steps. So confirm our final approach and move to what the guidance will look like. In the top 1,000 programme, it's a little bit different. Obviously, we touch those taxpayers less frequently. We only look at top 1,000 taxpayers once every 4 years, and it's retrospective. So we don't have that same real-time engagement. So the supplementary annual GST return, you know, is a bit of a game changer in that it gives us some visibility as to what's happening in the intervening period when we're not looking at these taxpayers. But it also helps us to tailor our engagement when we do come to engage. So like the currently, we seek to engage every 4 years. What the supplementary annual GST return is allowing us to do is in the right circumstances, or in all circumstances, tailor our engagement under that top 1,000 programme, and in certain circumstances, reduce our engagement significantly, and in some cases, actually not engage at all. So for certain taxpayers, again, it's the high assurance taxpayers that continue to demonstrate investment. You know, they provide high quality returns through the supplementary annual GST return, and we can see continued investment. In those cases, you know, it may be that there's no GST component to the what would otherwise be a combined assurance review. Yeah.
Thanks, Michelle. And thanks, David, for the overview in relation to the SAGR and then the purpose and how you're going to utilise what comes through in the filings for both top 100 and top 1,000 and those nuances. David, you touched on the fact that we've had sort of the pilot and the December closes filed in August. What are the ATO's learnings from those two rounds of filings?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say the pilot was great because it really helped us to refine some of the questions in the returns to make sure we were really getting information that was going to be useful to us to achieve our objective. It also gave us some insights around where further guidance might be required. David spoke about, you know, bolstering up some of the guidance on our web pages and things around issues where questions were raised. I think from the filings, which is a bigger pool that happened in August, so that's for those early balances for the 2025 income year, I think it's the insights that we're getting from the return that are really proving to us it's going to be of value to us in refining our or having confidence to take that lighter touch. So far there's been pretty high quality, David, comment on this, but really, you know, good quality in terms of the amount of detail that's being provided and how useful it is. Pleasingly, we can see across that population, there's continued investment in assurance. So we can see, you know, you've got stats around the number of people who are increasing in governance and in their view will have moved from, you know, having something effectively designed, saying to have something independently tested. We can see a large majority of the taxpayers, David, you said 75%, are completed the gap for that period and they were able to give us the statistics. So it's like another insight into how we can measure and have visibility across the population. Yeah.
And I think to generalise, I mean, I think it's clear from the responses that we're receiving that people appreciate that if they put the right amount of effort into the return, that it might have the, you know, the payoff in a sense of, you know, less resource investment or perhaps not even, you know, a GST component in a top 1,000 context in a moving forward. So I think people, you know, that with perhaps a few exceptions, there are a few pretty light ones, but you know, in general, I think people have done a pretty good job of giving us the type of information and the amount of detail that allows us to sort of, you know, maintain our assurance, but hopefully in a way that requires less resource investment.
I think from you touched on the return being straightforward, and I think in terms of what we've seen, it's been largely a straightforward process with, you know, sort of significant issues with complexity, but I think there's still, and largely that's due to, I think it was very helpful in terms of the consultation, the engagement, the pilot program, the engagement with market in terms of informing the return, but then ultimately the guidance that's been issued and then updated based on the pilot learnings. But I think there's still an acknowledgement that it's a filing obligation, so it does represent, you know, that that is a further investment by the large market in their tax control framework, that's resource, that's cost, that's time put on, you know, it, to an extent already stretched tax teams. So to your point in relation to then sort of seeing the benefits of that through lesser intensity in relation to future reviews, I think that'll be really important in building that sort of collaborative compliance and trusted approach between taxpayers and the regulator.
If I can add to that, I've obviously emphasised for high assurance taxpayers, they're likely to see the greatest benefit. And I spoke about the changes in the Top 100 programme. It will actually, you know, should actually benefit all taxpayers. Mm. Top 100, we have that, you know, constant engagement. But in the Top 1000 programme, that's really helping us to tailor our reviews, so all taxpayers should feel the benefit of that. Yeah.
Thank you. And I think earlier Lachlan touched on the return being one of governance, and that's exactly right. And I think for two reasons, the return we're seeing taxpayers are required to make that sort of assessment and statement as to their tax governance profile, whether they've maintained, increased their rating, whether they've undertaken tax controls testing. So there's the return, you're making that assessment on your tax governance profile, but it's also part of governance in terms of those that are living a robust tax control framework. I think the SEGA can be used as part of a tool, as part of that framework for that annual check-in in relation to technical risks, to governance, to testing, and it's that opportunity to provide and share, you know, the investment that you're making in uplift, in undertaking testing to influence that. Okay, I'm really keen to hear, so Jonathan, Woolworths were part of the pilot program for the SEGA. Can you share your experiences of going through the process and any insights for those that are about to embark on completion of the SEGA?
Yep. Thanks, Sasha. Maybe a little bit of sort of background for context purposes. Our initial JT review was FY20, so it started in January 21 and went to February 23, so it took a bit over 2 years to complete that. As part of the wrap-up for that, obviously FY24 was flagged as the refresh, so the four-year period later. So then back end of 24, ATO approached us around the pilot, which, you know, to participate in it, which from our perspective, you know, the ATO had stated the view, as we've heard around, having a more targeted, focused refresh review. So we thought, well, it's a bit of a no-brainer if we can do that as part of this responses. Hopefully then that'll, you know, when it comes to actually doing the FY24 review, it'll be much more targeted, less resource intensive. So we had a catch up with the tax office in November 24, phone call really to work through the questions, because that's the first time we're seeing them about what was expected, you know, what sort of answers are there, and also to discuss the purpose of the pilot around really understanding, are those questions clear, you know, in terms of that stated objective of, you know, being a more targeted review and you know, clarity to them, and the right sort of questions, and we'll get this, the right sort of information to help with that objective. Post that, then, we had a very quick turnaround because with the programme going live, we had to get a response back by February 25, so that was November we were discussing it, and then a very quick turnaround around that, given that Christmas was sort of in that period as well. So with that in mind, one of the things we didn't actually do as part of that was the GATT. I'm sure we'll talk about GATTs later and there'll be questions on that, but we specifically didn't do the GATT as part of that. Reason being is, as I said, you can imagine Christmas is a pretty busy time for a retailer, so, you know, you can't get anybody's attention in the business at that. Plus, we had half-year reporting obligations as well. So you've got your financial reporting team, you know, they've got their work scheduled in. We just couldn't do it. But we agreed that we would do the GAT as part of the FY24 review, which is kicked off. And I'll circle back then to what we're seeing around the RFI that we've literally just got there in the last couple of weeks on that. In terms of actually completing the questions, David's obviously spoken through those, so I'm not going to go into the individual questions, but I think what we found is as long as we maintained, I guess, as a business partner, that connection with the rest of the business around, you know, the ops teams and the commercial teams about where the business is going, what has happened within the organisation, and then also with the financial reporting teams and the other areas of business systems and IT, you know, we found it relatively straightforward to address the queries that we've gone through. Apart from, and I'm not using apart in a bad way, but I'll get into it, the recommendations bit was probably the more involved aspect. So we did have a very detailed review, obviously, over that two-year initial period. So there were some recommendations that came out of that. I think everybody gets recommendations. Post that review, we addressed a lot of those, you know, while they were fresh. But to be honest, after a couple of years of ATO review, we want to sort of get back to the day job a little bit. So we put a plan in place around those, so we addressed the immediate stuff, but put a plan in place around what else needed to be done, a bit of progression, not perfection, you know, around that. So we actually found it as quite a useful checkpoint to actually go back and say, well, what have we done, where we are in that journey, what do we need to do? So we made sure we sort of had at least addressed what we said we were, and also then thought about that timeline, what we had already sort of committed to. So we found that pretty useful, specifically around that recommendation four, about the question four, which I think has now been split up into three different parts. And obviously post that, we fed everything back, tried to be as, you know, full in those responses as we could, given we knew that would set the agenda for the FY24 review. Then we provide our responses back. There's sort of a debrief, you know, a process where we put our responses back, our observations, as I'm sure everybody else in the pilot did. Main ones around sort of, because I think we got the benefit of that one-on-one with the tax office around what was expected for those questions, what should we sort of be putting in. So it was good to see a lot of the instructions and that worked example was sort of implemented around that. And then there were some other bits about just sort of tightening up and some of the questions. I think there was originally a question in there about explaining unreconciled amounts, which could be challenging by the definition that they were unreconciled in the first place, so it was going to be hard to explain those sort of things. So I think that terminology has changed a little bit there. So I guess with these things in the proofs in the pudding about, you know, our current refresh review, we've got the questionnaire, RFI1, and it's a lot more targeted, focused. You know, there's definitely bits in there around showing how we've, you know, done what we've said that we were going to do under the saga. But, you know, our original RFI back in the day was, you know, 25, 30 questions, multiple questions. I think this time we've got 10 questions with not too many subpoints and stuff. So it's a lot more focused, as we would expect. I think the key three points maybe from our perspective was going back and looking at those ATO recommendations. You know, that's if you're trying to move the needle in terms of your governance, like that's where you're going to do it. You know, ATO has obviously made recommendations. What are you doing about it? And what's the plan? And again, it's not necessarily that they're all done. These things do take time, but at least there's a plan of attack around how you're actually going to address those. And ranking those in terms of where you get your biggest bang for your buck and what you can do quickly, what's it going to achieve. Second point, I think, which is was quite important, is that you have got that, obviously, that timeline, 7-month timeline between the end of the financial year and the return being due, but that can disappear very quickly. Especially, a lot of it's within the controls of the tax team, but there is interactions with other parts of the business, especially around the GAT and getting access to, you know, the financial reporting teams and their expertise. And you really have to engage up front, because if you go at the back end, they've got their own work, they've got their own schedule of stuff, you know, so you need to really engage early around that, about those interaction points and making sure it works. And I guess the third point around that was, like when you are making statements in the saga, when you're going back, like you don't need to provide this to the tax office at that time, but if you're making comments about how you think your governance has been updated, it's maintained, you know, it's collating that evidence at the time, because it's part of that, you know, refresh review when it actually happens. The ATO is going to ask you for that. You know, you made this statement, where's your objective evidence around that? Like, show us what you've actually done. Why did you make that statement within the saga? So overall, look, we found it beneficial for that purpose of the making sure that that review, which we knew we were already going to get, was actually a bit more targeted and focused. Yeah.
Thank you. And it's a really good point that you raise around the statements being made and then the objective evidence, which we'll touch on shortly. But I think, Chris, it'd be great to hear from you. I know you haven't been through the SAGA process as yet, but no doubt will be in preparations.
Subjected to it, yeah.
Okay. So keen to get your perspectives as a top 100 of how the SAGA fits within sort of top 100 compliance approach and, your views.
I guess the starting point, where I would start and the way I'm thinking about this is in four different ways. The first one, I've headed direction of travel. The second one is post-lodgement compliance, or engagement, I beg your pardon, post-lodgement engagement. The third one would be the interactions with the tax admin aspects of our tax system. And then the fourth lens is the what I'd call continuous improvement part of it. So going back to the direction of travel, I guess with quarter of a century of experience and having been subjected to every ATO product potentially ever created, whether it was audit, risk review, annual compliance agreements, pre-lodgement compliance obligations, real time, and our favourite justified trust, I see the SAGA as actually a little bit of a positive development in terms of the way we're travelling in compliance, particularly for the top 100. And I do speak for the top end of the top 100. So I think we were eighth last year at Westpac, but if you're 98th, maybe it's slightly different. But the top half of the top 100 has always had that real-time engagement. And I think justified trust sort of pulled the reins backwards a bit, and there was a lot more intensive engagement. But as I said, I think the direction of travel for the SAGA, I'm very positive about the way it's going, because I see it very analogous to what I consider to be the golden period of compliance, which was the annual compliance agreements, where you had real-time engagement. It was a combination of quantitative and qualitative engagement with the tax office, and you had sign-off. And so if we can get back to that, if the SAGA gets us to, especially for the top 100, gets us to the lighter touch, et cetera, I see the direction of travel being quite positive. Between the time that I signed up to appear today and the discussions we're having, what was also welcome and supports my view of the direction of travel is positive is the changed approach, the consultation document that the tax office has recently put out. Again, for me, that's a little bit of a bulwark of, well, we're really serious about if you tell us and you engage meaningfully, it's going to be a lighter touch. And that's something that, I guess, in this day and age, getting sign-off is probably a bridge too far. The way we used to get sign-off under the ACAs, mm-hmm. Love to get back to that. Yes, you can get sign-off through other products, but if the best we're going to get is a really light touch for top 100 and genuine, I can't remember the terminology, it was just lighter assurance for high assurance taxpayers, then I see a direction of travel being really positive. I actually also think it's well earned. If you do look at the tax office's top 100 report, you have a substantial amount of the tax base, substantial amount of taxpayers who are in the HAT category. And if they're not in the HAT category and they're in the medium assurance, I call them HATs and MATs, if you're in the MAT category, you're probably only there because you just haven't ticked one of the boxes. So I think we're pushing, the curve is heading in that direction. So I think from a tax system performance perspective, if there is a benefit of the JT process that everyone's gone through and went through or is still going through, and some of the lessons of previous products, I see the direction of travel with the SAGAR being quite positive. So I'd start with that one. In relation to, I guess, the way I'm thinking about JP's gone through a pilot, the way I'm thinking for my organisation are the top 100s, the process for what happens when the return's lodged, it really has to start. And if you're in the top end of the top 100, you're doing real-time engagement anyway. There is, you don't start at year end when the year finishes. You have to be implementing and have governance that you're doing this throughout the year, particularly because it's majority of the questions are not numbers, they're answers. And everyone knows if you don't write something down at the beginning of the year that you need to tell the tax office, you're going to really forget about it 7 months after when you have to tell them something. So you have to be thinking about this as a real-time disclosure type paradigm, not I have to start this when the year ends, because it's not numbers. You have to really remember what positions you've taken, what deals have been done, etc. And if we're in this real-time engagement with the tax office, and you, especially for material transactions, you're doing that, but you have to, I think, continue to do that. Things that I see, gaps that I see, immediate gaps in terms of the post-lodgement period, is the time frame. So it is a 7 month lodgement period. For taxpayers like ourselves who have obligations under the pre-lodgement compliance, where we lodge our we lodge things in relation to the previous year at the 6 month mark. Yes, it dovetails. So you're lodging a lot of your tax performance stuff at 6 months. You're lodging your qualitative answers at 7 months. If it just so happens to be half year and everyone's busy, we can still overcome that. But the time frame is important in terms of making sure that, if anything, it could be pulled forward. If you're a really taxpayer on your game, you could pull that forward, but 7 months is a really good starting point. I think where the 7 months, where I'm, the lived experience will be telling here will be, you send this into the tax office at the seventh month mark, how long before you get any response? So realistically, I think it'd be, you shouldn't expect to get something within 3 months where they've looked at everything, including your numbers, the numbers and your tax performance things that you've put through. And what is the response? So as we all know, we all have our stakeholders who will say, what are you working on? Well, I'm working on the SAGAR return. The expectation of the board and the board audit committee is, okay, well, that's been lodged. Did you get a gold star? So if the gold star is, well, they're looking at it and I won't know for 3 years whether it's going to be light touch, that messaging has to be very nuanced. But really the board doesn't appreciate uncertainty. So one of the things that I'm certainly looking with the guys having received the first lot of returns is, what is it like turning that around, and what's it like when you come back to talk to the taxpayer about, hey, thanks for your return. We have some further questions in relation to your answers here, but how quickly do we get nothing more required? And also, we think you're on that direction of lighter touch. So that's really important. Hasn't been a lot out there, but I guess that's the lived experience that we're in now. And managing stakeholders. And it affects the tax office as well. The tax office, we know, has a lot of reporting that it does. It has the same issues regarding timeframes, closing out issues. So it's all stakeholders. Top 100, especially the top end, do get letters from the commissioner about their performance. So all these things are measurable, and therefore we've got to be accountable. The interaction with the tax admin, I won't go too much into it, but it is a return. It engages the tax administration. How it engages is something that, again, I'm looking into. Penalties, information if you are filling out the gap and it's wrong. Review rights if something comes up as a result of the return and there's a dispute. And we do have the significant global entity provisions that can really impact on penalties. But I think there might be some more on that in a minute. And then the last lens that I have that I'm looking at it is from the continuous improvement straight away. So everyone knows as soon as you do something and you put a product out, you really should start testing how it's going. What do I see there immediately? I'm sure the tax office will do a post-implementation review of its first lot of returns, how it interacts with some of the other frameworks I mentioned that taxpayers are already in, real-time engagement, duplication of responses, PCR lodgement, things like your rating. So if you do disclose under a PCR an issue, you can get a low risk rating. Does that carry through with when you put it on the SAGAR, or if something changes because the tax office has now thought about it? But my main concern regarding continuous improvement is to limit duplication. I think that's a trap for any compliance, is if we're telling the tax office things three times and they're receiving it three times over the course of a year, it's not great. Wouldn't be doing my job if I wasn't mentioning that input tax suppliers are sort of carved out of this changed assurance. But again, in the future, everybody should be subject to the same system. So you should be able to still get lighter touch, even if you're an input tax supplier, but that's something we can work to. I guess that was my take.
Thanks, Chris. Might just touch on so you mentioned the penalty regime, and David, you touched on it being a filing obligation. It's not an RFI. It's subject to the same penalty regime as a BAS income tax return. Michelle, are you able to perhaps sort of share some more context around ATO's expectations as to the substance of the responses, the evidence that you're maintaining in ensuring that there's been no failure to take reasonable care?
Yeah, thanks. And this is something that we've tried to kind of address through our additional guidance, web guidance. So we're not too worried about non-lodgement. We've had the first set of lodgements for the early balances already come through. David, you said we're writing to people. We're notifying people in a couple of different ways. And what we saw was that there was high lodgement rates. There are a few instances where there was non-lodgement. And what we identified from that is it's very important to keep contact details on the ATO systems up to date. So that's just a reminder for everyone there. I think with no exception, all of those issues were kind of resolved quite quickly.
Correct.
In terms of, I suppose, penalties around false and misleading statements, which is really what we're talking about, you know, our existing guidance is relevant here. So we've got a practice statement from 2012, which talks about how we consider penalties. I think, you know, if I had to boil it down quite simply, where returns are lodged on time, we can see that the response is comprehensive and there has been a genuine attempt to respond to a question in a fulsome way, and that you have, you know, evidence to support, should we ever ask about it, that you have evidence to support the position that you've taken, you know, we're unlikely to impose a penalty. We'll have regard to the facts and circumstances, of course, but what I would say is it is important that there isn't an even playing field. So we see a spectrum, right, in terms of compliance and engagement, and it's important that where we do see non-compliance, that there's, you know, inappropriate circumstances, which we think are going to be kind of few and far between, but if it was appropriate, that there is some kind of recourse. Because obviously, in order for us to be able to do our job and, you know, obtain assurance over these taxpayers, it's important that we're provided with relevant information. Yeah.
Thank you. In terms of, I'm conscious of leaving a little bit of time because the Q&A is running hot here, but we might just close out with, so we talked about the return itself being straightforward, but in terms of, I suppose, you mentioned sort of 75% had completed the GAT, 25% had not. Just observations in relation to the GAT, and there are some Q&A coming through in relation to what's going to be the impact for those that have done it versus those that have not. Perhaps if we can get some ATO observations initially.
I'll make it quick, because in case any other panel members want to comment. So the GAT is obviously provides that reconciliation to what's in your financial statements versus what's in your BAS. It is the fourth pillar of our JT. So it's a mandatory part of, with the exception of predominantly input tax applies, it's a mandatory part of our justified trust reviews. In terms of our stance, it hasn't changed. So we always looked at it as part of our JT reviews, and as part of good governance, we always saw it as best practice that the GAT was embedded, or you know, similar reconciliation, that the GAT was embedded into internal controls and that there was a procedure that supported it, you know, and maybe eventually it's independently tested. So the stance hasn't changed there, and the supplementary annual GST return also hasn't created an additional obligation. So the return simply says, have you done it or haven't you done it? And if you have done it, what was the outcome? I think what's been consistent, though, through all of this is that the more information we have, the better positioned we are to make decisions about how we tailor our engagement and, you know, reduce some intensity. So I think we've said it several times now, but the more comprehensive the information in the return, the more likely taxpayers are to benefit from reduced intensity through our questions. And I'll say, if the GAT hasn't been prepared, it's a precondition for that to be eligible for the assurance check-in in the top 100 programme. So if there is no GAT, we would do a tailored review. And as part of that tailored review, we would seek to engage with taxpayers as a starting point to do that top-down reconciliation, because it really helps us to identify where there are differences and where we might investigate further, I suppose. So it will, even where it hasn't been done before, the return is lodged, that will be a part of our engagement with you, obtaining relevant information. And if we can't get sufficient information to do the GAT, well, then we're more likely to conduct other assurance activities to get some assurance over correct reporting. Yeah.
Thank you. Any other observations in relation to the GAT?
I could, but why don't you leave some time for your question?
Might jump into, so there's a number of Q&A and then we'll open it up to the room. But a question here is, I would like to understand why the ATO is interested in knowing about the credits referable to earlier periods. So question 15, where is the mischief?
In terms of corrections relating to earlier periods, I suppose this gives us visibility as to what is happening, and we wouldn't necessarily otherwise have that visibility through the returns that are lodged with us. We appreciate that for GST, where there's often like high volume of transactions and errors will happen, that necessarily there may be corrections, and actually we see it, provided they're not huge and continual, as a sign of good governance. Like through your own governance, you're identifying errors and you're correcting them quickly. But it does just give us some visibility. So it's not necessary that we would see that as indicating something that would give us a concern. But it gives us like an important reference point.
Yeah, of itself, it's not ringing alarms. But it tells us that information that we wouldn't otherwise have, that we would want to know. And in some cases, it may not play out in an assurance context. In some cases, it may be something that is of concern and we want to think of outside of an assurance context. The purpose is to give us this information that we wouldn't have otherwise, and then we work out what it is that we want to do with that. But just the fact of a retrospective claim that's referable to some, you know, prior year, that doesn't alarm us. It's information that we'll work out what to do about.
I think on the next question, JP, you'd mentioned in terms of the pilot program, it was helpful that you had the ATO engagement in relation to completion of the SAGA, and Chris, you touched on sort of being able to report up to the board. It would be helpful to know sort of what the outcome of the SAGA is, so that you can demonstrate sort of where you're at and what the outcome is. The question was, will there be any ATO engagement with taxpayers, either top 100, top 1,000, post-filing of the SAGA?
Yeah. So Not every year. So currently in top 100, where you're at medium or high assurance, which is the vast majority of the population, we effectively do or have engagement every fourth year. And in the intervening period, it's monitor and maintenance. So that won't change. We won't now start writing to you on a regular basis to acknowledge the responses in the return. It will form part of our monitoring and maintenance activities, and we'll only really reach out if there's something we think worth talking to you about. It will be the same for the Top 1000 programme. In the fourth year, when it's informing our engagement, it will look different for different taxpayers. So high assurance taxpayers in the Top 100 programme who are eligible for that assurance check-in that I spoke about, they can expect to receive a letter. So, you know, it's intended it will be comprehensive and can cover in substance what we have reviewed and that we're able to maintain our level of assurance or otherwise, but it will be abridged, and that's, you know, intended to reduce, you know, the level of investment in these reviews. For some top 1,000 taxpayers, they won't have a review at all, and they'll be told, thanks for your response, based on what we've seen, there's no GST component of your review. And for everyone else, so it's really kind of some of those ineligible high assurance taxpayers and or medium assurance taxpayers, they can expect a more tailored TAR. So we'll continue to communicate on our assurance ratings through our assurance products. Mm. We won't be separately communicating to you in response to the supplementary annual GST return. Yeah.
Thank you. And might just, we're at time, but one last question for Jonathan and Chris. There's a question in relation to whether the SAGAR, and probably Justified Trust more broadly, has helped to lift the profile of indirect tax in your business. And how?
I mean, indirect tax at the minute, especially in GST, is pretty much food classification as far as I can tell. So we definitely do get a profile internally at a very large food retailer. So we're trying not to have too much of a profile, to be honest. But sometimes that can be helped. Look, it does, because I think through, you know, tax transparency reports, Woolworths reports, what are ratings is, both from an income tax perspective and also a GST perspective. So, you know, it's public documents that's out there. So we've had the high rating. Income tax got there first from a, so, you know, so it does help. And a little bit of rivalry internally between the indirect and the corporate tax guys. So it does set that benchmark. So, and I think also then through the SEGA, at least it gives us a pathway and an outline that we can have that discussion within the business about why you're doing things. So it goes back to the GAT and talking about whether it was mandatory or not. I'm not sure whether the GAT's mandatory or strongly recommended or expectations around it, but at least you can have that conversation now with other parts of the business about why you're doing stuff. Mm. You know, previously it wasn't quite clear, well, what happens if we don't? Well, we might get more, you know, data testing, or we might get more controls testing. The organisation said, well, fine. We're happy to live with that, but at least now you can set out, you know, or have those conversations about why you're doing things. So, yeah.
I would just echo what JP's saying. I mean, we certainly, our organisation, we operate in a highly regulated environment, and relationships with regulators are front of mind on pretty much every part of the organisation, which is why it is important that anything that we're doing is measurable, and we're accountable both ourselves, but also when the regulator actually is writing to the board, etc., that things have been signed off and we're able to actually articulate that we're a high assurance taxpayer for a reason, and these are the reasons, because we've engaged meaningfully, whether it's through this product or something else.
Thanks, Chris. We are at time, and we're standing between us and lunch now, so we'll close it out there. Please join me in thanking our panelists. Lunch break now, and we'll resume at 2 p.m.